when I looked at that 1040 and saw that they together made $28,000 and that they had supported me, and here I was being able to attend probably one of the best universities in our state and nation, it was sad, but I saw the struggle. And when I even think that I want to give up, I can't. Because people like this put their life on the line so that I could have better opportunities. And so those are the moments where when you ask yourself, what am I doing here? I'm standing on other people's shoulders. And so I don't want to squander the opportunities that people gave me.
Please take 2 seconds to click the follow or subscribe button on your podcast player. You can set it once and forget tracking down each weekly episode. This makes your life easier and signals to the algorithms that the show should be recommended to other listeners. A simple act that can have an outsized positive impact on others. Now, let's get to it. Albert Einstein said, "Don't think about why you question, simply don't stop questioning." Welcome to Curated Questions. I am your host, Ken Woodward. And these questions are not mathematical equations, but rather a resource to encounter personal reflection and growth. As Tupac Shakur stated, even the genius asks questions. Now, let's engage the questioning community. Greetings. Ken Woodward here. Welcome back to another episode of Curated Questions. Together, we engage inquisitive humans about how they use questions to navigate and make sense of our world. I am a fellow traveler and pilgrim on this journey, and I'm glad you are here. Today's conversation is with Dr. Littoral Faison. Faison is an HBCU and Virginia State University professor, poet, author, independent scholar, and senior military spouse. A graduate of the University of Virginia Tech and Virginia State University, she holds undergraduate and graduate degrees in English and a doctoral degree in education. Faison is chair of the Department of Languages and Literature and assistant professor of English at Virginia State University and has authored over 16 books. Faison's research study, The Missed Education of the Negro, an examination of the Black segregated experience in Southampton County, Virginia, 1950 to 1970, focused on Riverview High School, a segregated Black high school that existed in Cortland, Virginia, and explores the nuances of Black segregated education during the Jim Crow era. Faison's latest work, Nursery Rhymes in Black, was released in June of 2025 and blends tradition, memory, and resistance through a reimagination of familiar childhood rhymes through the lens of Black history and lived experience. This volume just received a Pulitzer Prize nomination, the heartiest of congratulations. Not one to rest on her laurels, her next work, Blood at the Root, will be released in the coming months, which speaks directly to the historical and ongoing violence, erasure, and resilience that define the African-American experience. Littoral, welcome to Curated Questions.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here, to be in conversation with you today.
This will be a glorious conversation, I am sure. So I always like to start at the same point, and that is asking, when did you first understand the power of questions?
I was raised by my grandparents in a very small southern town. And just in that, being raised by my grandparents, just that I could stop there with the power of questions. Honestly, I have not written that book yet. I've written about my grandparents quite a bit. But I remember being a child, probably as young as 5 or 6, and having been raised in a Black church, I was introduced to God at a very early age. And I just remember probably my first question was to God. And most of those questions had to do with why I was born in the way that I was and in the circumstances that I was in. And that was being grandparent raised. Many kids who are grandparent raised often think that kids who are parent raised are in a better situation. And so being a 5, 6, or 7 year old, and I was around my parents I knew them, but it just didn't make sense. And then there are several things that came out of that experience. And being grandparent raised, I was fortunate enough to know both sides of my family because we were all in the same town. But just the circumstances, and I often wondered, why me? Why in that way? Why was my life on this trajectory? And so that was probably the first question that I asked. And there was power in that. Because when I look at my life and how things turned out, and I'm a self-reflector, so I was always reflecting. I did well in elementary school. I did well in middle school and high school and then college. And my grandparents were these hardworking people, not formally educated at all, but they were very wise. And so as I started to look at my life, I knew early on, I made a connection with the self-identity question and God. And so there was an innate experience or an innate knowledge that I was born with purpose and that I was born for a reason. And even though I gained a grasp on that early on, even as a kid, as life went on, because life happens, I still found myself asking that question. And not always necessarily of God, but just of myself. Why am I here? What is my purpose? And I think that there is power in that and understanding where you fit into the world, why you're here in a particular moment to experience whatever it is, joy, pain, whatever. And one of the things that I say in the beginning of this book, and it comes from a line, is that she who loves must learn to organize pain. Not only was that my grandmother, but it was also me, because I'm 52 now. But I want to look at my life from the age of as early as 4 and 5 and 6. And as we start to understand things, that's what we're doing. We're organizing pain. And I watched my grandmother hearing her stories that she organized a lot of pain. And I got to witness that. But also in my 52 years, I also had to organize a lot of pain. And I think that if you can organize pain and move on and love, that is powerful. That's powerful. And so the question, who am I? Why am I here? That's a question I probably ask myself more times than I care to remember as a younger person. But as I grew older, I've asked myself that question less, because with every decade, it seems that I've come to know exactly why I'm here, exactly why I was born that way, exactly why my mother was a teenager. And then I was sent to be reared by these two individuals in this particular town, in this space, at this church, with these educators. Everything means something.
Please take 2 seconds to click the follow or subscribe button on your podcast player. You can set it once and forget tracking down each weekly episode. This makes your life easier and signals to the algorithms that the show should be recommended to other listeners. A simple act that can have an outsized positive impact on others.
And so I think there lies the power of a question.
And how did that, in you carrying this question with you then and revisiting? So I think that there's quite the beauty in revisiting a question, because you've had a chance to say early 50s. So over 5 decades,
yes,
you've had a chance to ebb and flow and dance with this question a little bit.
Yes.
So what has that experience been like for you as it has changed over the years? Or what emphasis on what syllables are, how is that working as there's been the different demands of even out of school with military, spouse, and moving around, and the emphasis on raising. You got three boys, I understand.
Yes.
And also this work that you've been doing. What has that conversation been like? And what are the markers where you might have wanted to go back and revisit what that purpose is?
Wow. Over 5 decades, I will admit that the questioning has not always been joyful. It hasn't always been positive. There have been times when I asked myself that question and I was in tears. Most people, I never see me cry. But when I think about the decades, and so I made it into my 20s. And I say I made it into my 20s. And when I say I made it into my 20s, that kind of illustrates that there was some struggle there. and making it into your 20s, especially if you are thinking a lot about life and about family and about circumstances and how hard things are and how right after you get over one thing, there's another thing to get over. And out of my 20s and through college, of course, I went into marriage and then motherhood. And so with that, then you're dealing with your professional life. And I don't think the question has... Sometimes I've asked myself that question in total, like, melancholy, like, especially when you feel like you failed at something. There are indeed a lot of moments. I always tell people marriage is probably one of the biggest decisions you will make in your life. And I have an amazing husband. We've known each other since sixth grade, but even though he's amazing and he thinks I'm amazing, that doesn't make for challenges not to come your way. With us being a military family, he did 3 overseas tours. So there were some times when I was by myself. When he was deployed to war, our older sons were 4 and 5 or 3 and 4. Mm-hmm. So I was left in Fort Hood, Texas. That was a moment that would make any young mom throw up her hands and holler and say, why me? Why me? Why now? But I didn't really do that. Those kinds of questions, I'm the kind of person, I sulk and I move on, but I need space to sulk. I need space to be sad. I need space to ask those questions. And most us religious people, we say we have relationships with God and we believe that God hears us. But I think probably the tough question is a conversation that I'm always having with God. And then Ntozake Shange wrote those lines, I found God in myself. So am I having those conversations with God? Or am I having those conversations with me? And so when you ask, how have I found power? It's empowering for me to ask myself those questions. Whether it's every year, every 5 years, there's something about self-reflection and self-question that keeps me on track. Like now I'm taking on this new role as department chair. When I ran, as any politician does, when you run, you have all these amazing ideas that you put on paper. But then once you're in the seat, it's okay, where do I go from here? What do I do now? How do I best move and flow to affect the people that I'm leading? And so that's how I live my life. I don't think the question has changed for me as much. I think it's just as effective when I ask myself that question at 20, 30, 40, and 50 as it was when I asked myself at 7 and 15. I have always believe that the answers are within. I have always believed that the power and endurance is within. Now, it's probably a case of nature versus nurture. I've been surrounded by people who just never gave up. That was the story, was you just keep going, you press through it. And so giving up was not an option. But I will say this, probably almost every time I would have to ask myself, why am I here? It was a moment where someone weaker may not have made it. And so I know I'm a very strong person because people give up every day. People give up every day. People commit suicide every day because they feel like they just can't go on. And so those were moments where I was probably there, but it just was never in me to give up. And there have been some challenging moments where I felt like giving up. Again, those questions take me back to, and you've always known from the time you were young, that there's a reason that you're here. There's a reason why you exist. And even in a moment where I can't understand, or a place, because we've been in a lot of places, I think about our military life and how we were just all over the place. And I'm a verbal complainer. My husband is probably the person I have most complained to, but he understands and he knows that the complaining is like venting, tossing things up. I don't know that there's ever been a moment where he thought I wasn't going to bounce back from something. But I'm a fire sign. And so I feel things. I respond. And whether it's something that's making me happy, sad, or mad, it's hard for me to hide it, let alone in my facial expressions, but just in my verbal responses. And so I've always tried to be honest with who I am. And I've always tried to understand what it takes for me to exist in the world, what it takes for me to press on or to succeed. And then being a wife and being a mom and being an educator, I have always taken, even as a kid, before I had a husband and a child, I always took leadership seriously. I always took the fact that some other kid somewhere was watching me, perhaps saw me as a role model. I always took that seriously. So it matters to me who I am in the world, what I project, because there's always someone watching. And then when you get married and you have children and you're teaching in all of these spaces, there's always someone watching.
Always someone watching. Do you internalize that as a burden?
I absolutely do not. And I'm glad that you asked the question that way, because that question that you asked, that is a question in a way that I have posed to my students probably for as long as I've been teaching. But especially now that I'm teaching at an HBCU, and this is my second HBCU, I taught at Johnson C. Smith University down in North Carolina almost two decades ago. But now in my HBCU classes where I teach and serve and mentor mostly African-American students or students who are of African descent, that is a question, speaking of questions, that I ask them almost every semester. I teach about 100 students a semester. I won't do that anymore as chair, but I always ask the question, and it's phrased this way. How many of you feel that you have a responsibility to your race? You just asked me, was it a burden? No, I've never seen it as a burden. I was raised by people who were born in 1919 and 1932. And so they were always taught that in order to be an African-American in America, in public, that you had to bring 100% in order to measure up. And I remember my grandma saying, as many other Black mothers and possibly white and other mothers have said this too, when you go out of this house, you represent us. You represent your family outside of this house. And so the way you speak, the way you dress, the way you carry yourself, it matters. And so I never saw it as a burden. I saw it as a responsibility. And I've carried that with me my whole life, no matter where I am. I've been the only Black person in a lot of rooms. And I don't know that it's something that I consciously do, but when I ask students now, do you feel a responsibility to your race? Many African-American students say no. I get very few hands raised, and that gives me pause. And it's a double-sided coin because they have the discussion. Students say, I don't feel that I should have to represent an entire race. And I think about the progress that we've made in terms of race in this country. But then I wonder sometimes if they're a bit jaded in thinking that they don't. And once we have the discussion, because I talk about how they often wear paraphernalia with our college name on it. Yeah. And I say, many of you did not grow up here in Virginia, even where we teach right now. I'm on the south side of Richmond. So it's rural. It's very rural, but we get students who come from all over. And so I say, when you go into Walmart or Target or wherever you are as a student, when people see you with Virginia State University on your shirt, they know you're a student. You're representing Virginia State, whether you like it or not. People are making assumptions about Virginia State University and the students that we have based on how you're carrying yourself in public. And so usually once we have this discussion, it's that a lot of them have not really thought about what it means. And some of them are actually representing their families and doing it, but I think never really gave thought to the fact that it's a responsibility or that I'm doing it. And we do have a responsibility to each other, to our families. But I think that is a conversation to be had. And I think it's a great place to start with young people, as we can't assume that everybody got the lessons that we got. And that was a lesson that my grandma literally emphasized every week. If whether we were going to church or a friend's house, I was just thinking about a friend of my grandmother's who was very strict. And when we would go over there, my grandmother would say, hey, don't get over there and ask for food because that'll give the impression that I didn't feed you before I left home. These are the impression matter. And as a kid, like the students that I'm teaching, I used to think, oh, that's crazy. If the lady offers us a cookie or a lemonade, why can't we take it? But let me tell you, my grandmother and many Black mothers, they didn't play that. If I said, don't eat anything when we get over there, don't eat anything. Because it did matter. There were people who would assume that, oh, her kids came over here and they ate up everything. It's older people are wiser. They've lived through it. And there's always a reason why they have these little lessons that they try to teach us. But I think what I carried was, you represent your family. You represent your race. I grew up in Southampton County, and I was born in the early 70s, post-segregation. And the way things looked at my house and the way things looked at my church were different as opposed to the way they looked in the town. And I had to come to grips with these sort of things. I was at school and we were in a mixed environment, but my relationships with my white peers literally ended every Friday at 3 o'clock. You didn't see them on Saturdays or Sundays. You didn't go to their houses. They didn't come to yours. You didn't go to their birthday parties. You didn't go to their churches. And I really thought about that a little bit later. And as I've been writing, reflecting on home and memory, these are the things that you don't. There was an Indian family who ran a motel in Cortland. And now that I'm 52, and as I've been writing these things, I was like, I never took the time to go know that Indian family. I never went to that hotel, but I often wondered, gosh, I rarely saw them in the town anywhere. And they had children. And their children went to school somewhere, but not my school. So I don't know if they were homeschooled or if they were private schooled, but it's just very interesting when you look at a place like Cortland and how when I grew up, I share this with my students, everybody was Black or white. There were no other people other than that one Indian family. And then everybody was Christian or not. I think we had a population of Jehovah's Witnesses. But you didn't have the diversity of religions or religious thought. And you didn't have, surely didn't have the diversity of races.
Yeah.
And so the word xenophobia was never a part of my life growing up in the rural South. That word kind of came into play when I went into college and there were all these diverse ethnicities and students from Turkey and the Middle East and Africa and various other countries. So it was really eye-opening. You leave the town and you have to look back and see this place that you thought was larger than life growing up. You have to leave it and you look back on it and you're like, wow, we were so unexposed.
Tracking. Yeah. Yes. I didn't grow up in a town quite as small, but Central Arizona. Yeah, it's really white. And joining the Navy opened up my eyes to a broader spectrum of people and backgrounds, all those same kind of things that you just talked through. And it's a bigger world out there.
It really is. And when I think about how I spent the first 18 years and you as in that space, and no doubt that space shapes you. That space shapes your foundation, your belief system. And then you keep living and you have to start questioning that belief system and that foundation that you had in these very early years of your life with the people who loved you the most. And I think that's probably, I don't want to say the scariest part about life, but I think that is certainly a hard part because sometimes we don't like to challenge what we've always known. And if it came from our parents, if it came from our grandparents, they must have been right. And so it's very hard, but I was one of those kids who challenged a lot of things early on.
How did questions play a role in that challenging things early on? Were you just peppering? Let me start there because I got a couple follow-up. Let's see how that goes.
I really wanted to know. My grandmother, I grew up in an era where the way they raised kids back then was you were seen and not heard. You couldn't be a verbal kid. But I was a smart kid. I was a kid on the honor roll, and so they thought I was smart. Probably wasn't that smart. I just remember some questions I could ask, but my grandparents a lot of times wouldn't have. Most of the advice that they gave was in the life that they lived, how they treated people, how hard they worked, their work ethic, how they loved other people, how they helped in the community. My grandparents were foster parents. And not only did they take me in at 2 weeks old, I grew up with foster brothers who had come from all kinds of situations. In fact, one of my foster brothers he transitioned this week. He's younger than me. Wow. And the last time I talked to him, he said, "Will you write about me one day?" And we had never had any conversations like this. His name was Brian, and Brian was just a character growing up, kept us laughing. But when I think back on it, he made me, just thinking of him and him transitioning this week, made me think about home again. So it's like almost everything takes you back to that space. And my grandmother raised a lot of kids. I was one of them who made it. A lot of them didn't make it. And so when we think about these questions, we all came from various circumstances. We had the same, a lot of times people will ask the question, how can you all be come out of the same house and kids end up so different? It happens.
It does.
It really does happen. Everybody's not dealing with the same anything. The same. We're just, even if you came from the same parents, you all didn't get the exact same genes. And you can be in a house with the same people getting the same lesson, but it's how much of that you're able to hold and turn into something that projects in your own life. And it's easy to say that. And my husband does remind me all the time. He says, not everybody is as strong as you. When I think about that in terms of how we look at people in the world, I've had people infer that Black people should just get over slavery. And they seem to think that people like me, who succeeded in whatever way, were able to get over it. But we haven't. It's just people internalize things differently. It's almost asking a kid who just lost their mom at 10 to get over it.
Yeah.
Some kid, one of the kids may go on and do well and another one may not, but how we internalize grief is different. And so this entire book, Nursery Rhymes in Black, it is a collection of poems where I have worked through grief, because the poem that I wrote that started this collection was Mama Was a Negro Spiritual. And how that poem came to be, my grandmother at 76, which is not very old now that I'm 52, but when she was 76, she was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And that's a quick cancer. And she was gone in 3 months.
Wow.
So when you think of, we find out you have it in June and you're gone in September, that was very tough to deal with. And to lose a parent in that manner, I think you're in shock. But I remember we had this amazing homegoing celebration for her. And I remember taking the podium in the church and everybody thinking I was either going to sing a song or I was definitely going to do a poem. But I couldn't, because there was nothing but numbness. And I didn't want to do any poem. I could have found a poem that somebody else wrote about losing your mother, but I just couldn't do it. And I wanted the poem that I wrote it about my grandmother, because it was so much to her life. I wanted it to be an amazing poem. So I refused to read any poem or even try to write a poem. And so that poem came together, and I finished that poem, I believe, when we were living overseas in South Korea. And it came together as Mama Was a Negro Spiritual, because I felt that's who she was. She was a book that I had read, like a guidebook that I had for my life. And even though she was this person, most everyone in Cortland knew her, Black and white, because that's the kind of person she was. But I wanted whatever poem I wrote about her to be iconic. It had to be big. And so I wrote that poem. And of course, I tore it with what kind of poem it was going to be. Was it going to be a rhyming poem? And it ended up being a prose style poem, but there's meter in it. There's lyric in it. You can hear it. And so I wrote that poem in Korea, started sharing it. The poem won the Tom Howard Poetry Prize. It beat out over 1,500 entries. And so that was really a nice confirmation to hear the reviewers and the judges talk about that poem and how strong it was. But that was grief work. Writing that poem was grief work for me, paying tribute to my grandmother, honoring her. And so once I did that poem, others came about that experience. And that's really how this book, Nursery Rhymes in Black, came to be. And even though you're talking about family, if you're talking about Black family, racism is going to come up. Religion is going to come up. Spirituality is going to come up. Family, how we do family. all sorts of things are going to come up. Motherhood. So you get any number of topics and subjects in this book.
I have enjoyed reading through, and I do love the diversity and the richness of topic that you cover. And I look forward to spending more time with it as well. I've learned that anytime you're reading poetry, it needs to be out loud, listening for and experiencing it. So as I read this aloud, it was a joy to experience.
Yeah. Just in this poem alone, Mama Was a Negro Spiritual, I cover a lot of ground. And one of the things, if I may read this one now, is the way that it ends. And we'll talk about the way it ends. But I'm going to read the poem and then we can talk about how it begins, how it ends. Mama was a Negro spiritual. She was a good night prayer, a moon that shined down through my bedroom window. She was the alphabet, a Sunday school verse, a third Sunday gospel song to rehearse, a mostly misunderstood exchange of power, responsibility, and command. She was a black 73 Ford LTD, a Nottoway River crossing, a house filled with too many other folks' children, an orphan that life and death left behind to find, to give some joy. She was a funeral going, everybody in Southampton County knowing, bad manner destroying pillar of strength. She was a Friday evening ride to town, a Saturday morning cleaning, a Sunday go to meeting kind of human being. She laughed louder than Jim Crow's law and cried softer than God's peace. She was the secret I never told, the carrying of some other man and woman's burden. She was rare, uncut, black and picked up, ripped from some earthen mine, placed beneath a sharecropper's kind to bear witness, to bear it all deep down inside. She was a black hearse, a deaf man walking, a raising and waving of tired hands. She was thunder. She was lightning, a heavy rain that fell in spring. She was a third grade education, small town syndication. Her house, a book, a good book, and she the words penned fervently, permanently on all its pages. She was a Ridley Rhodes scholar, a kitchen where cooking got done and well. She was Miss Shirley, the lunch lady, bus driver, Sammy's wife, giver of too much self. Mama was a Negro spiritual, a hymn hum from inside a Baptist hymnal in an old rocking chair from a corner of our living room. She was a wisdom no man could whistle, a fancy no woman could fake, a journey none living in the now could take. She was an old-fashioned lyric. Everybody could lift their voice and sing.
Thank you.
So I begin that poem with, she was a good night prayer, a moon that shined down through my bedroom window. And for as early as I can remember, my grandmother had me on my knees. I can remember probably from the time I could speak. And she taught me that prayer that most people teach their babies. And for me, it was, now I lay me down to sleep, I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. I was looking at a version of that prayer in someone's book this week, and they took out, or maybe their parents didn't teach it that way, the part that said, if I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. That was heavy.
When you think about it,
that is heavy. But I never thought about that as being heavy or scary growing up. But when I look in children's books now, when I see that prayer, I see that it's removed. And so my grandmother had that sort of presence. And being in that life and being raised in that environment as an African-American in this working family, you knew the struggle. We were taught that there was a struggle. It wasn't sugarcoated. And so just in that simple prayer, and then I end the poem by saying that she literally was a Negro spiritual. She was an old-fashioned lyric. Everybody could lift their voice and sing. And of course, the amazing National Negro Anthem that James Weldon Johnson and his brother wrote, that's important to me. But so in this poem, I didn't even realize I was doing it. I thought I was talking about my grandmother in this poem. But in this poem, I'm not only talking about her, I'm talking about the place. I'm talking about Cortland. I'm talking about Southampton County, the road on which I grew up. And you get so many different images. And so when I look back, I told you that initial question, why am I here? Why was I born this way? You get to reflect and you find meaning in your origins. And so there are meaning in my origins. I'm proud that I came from Cortland. I'm proud that I was raised by my grandparents. Those are the things that you grow. And because life has turned out well, you can say these things. I can't imagine if life didn't turn out well. I might not be saying I'm proud of these things. But there was a lot of positivity, a lot of strength, a lot of teaching, a lot of resilience taught in that upbringing. And so those are the things that we want to carry and capture with us, no matter where we came from, no matter what life was, no matter what people we were given to. I think someone said, you can't help to who you're kin to. No, you can't help to who you're connected to. Yeah. But I'm thankful that not everything about that life was absolutely great, but not everything about that life was horrible either. And that life did make me. That life defined me, shaped me, molded me. And I was able to walk away from it and make some pretty good decisions, I think. From the decision to who I married, to where I went to college, to where I chose a job, to the type of people that I decided to surround myself with, and how I decided to raise my own children. And so when we think of home in that way, and that wasn't the only experience that shaped me. Of course, being on that college campus for 4 years and that amazing diversity. We talk about the University of Virginia. And if you've been reading the news, you hear what the University of Virginia is going through right now with the resignation of President Ryan and they're trying to erase DEI in these spaces. Those are the experiences that make us. I met you at Nikki Giovanni's memorial. And I likely would not have met you, Ken, if I had not gone to UVA, ended up at Virginia Tech, met Nikki, influenced by her, and then we meet at her memorial. Think about that for questions.
Yeah. That is
a
beautiful bunch of points connected. That is for sure. What is a specific smell or color that reminds you of your grandmother?
Sweet potato pie. And it's probably not just one scent. My grandmother loved fried fish, so she fried fish a lot. Sweet potato pie. But she also made a lot of cobblers. Apple cobblers, blueberry cobblers, cherry cobblers. So just the scent of food. There was always a food aroma because my grandmother was a cook. She drove a school bus. In addition to being a domestic worker and working in people's homes, she drove school bus and cooked in the school cafeteria. And probably her and every other Black woman at our church could cook really well. And so we lived for those events growing up. In the Black church, we had revivals, we had family days, we had all kinds of things, but there was always food. And so my grandmother could cook, she could bake, but those sweet aromas, you love to wake up to her bacon on a Saturday morning. And she would bake for other people. I talk a lot about, I think I mentioned in this book in some of the poems, Ingram's Funeral Home, okay? Ingram's Funeral Home was the small funeral home. It was Black owned in our town. And people die all the time. Like almost every week someone's passing away. And my grandmother, they lived in that tradition where you had to go down to the funeral home and pay your respects. And so I was always in tow to the funeral home. And I didn't necessarily hate it because there was culture in that in these visits. Because you weren't going just to view a body. You were seeing people. Much like the way you and I met at Nikki's memorial, at Nikki's viewing.
Yeah.
But I would go with Mama to this tiny funeral home and she'd see all the people from the town and all of this conversation is falling off on me. But I remember when people passed away in the Black community, everybody would bake food or take food or make food to take to the house. Mm. And their food was a huge part of life. At home, at church, every summer there were family reunions to be had. I can't even believe some of the things that I mentioned in this book. When I grew up, there was a family called the Butts family. They don't even know they're in this book. But there was a family called the Butts family, and they lived on the Wakefield Road where my maternal grandparents lived. But they lived up in this big field that it was like a cornfield. It was a big old house. But every 4th of July, they would have a big old 4th of July festival. And everybody would go. People would just go. They would have a DJ. They would fry fish. But it was just the thing to do in the country, to go to the Butts 4th of July cookout.
Gotcha.
And those people are no longer there. Their son lives there. But I was thinking how I mentioned that in this book. I mentioned that was the highlight of a summer, to be able to go to that reunion.
Please take 2 seconds to click the follow or subscribe button on your podcast player. You can set it once and forget tracking down each weekly episode. In 2023, I went back to my hometown, a place I grew up from 2 to 18. I hadn't spent any time there since I had left for the military in December of 88. And there had just been a longing to go back. So in 2023, I went and spent 3 days. And I wasn't there to see anyone in particular, met up with the father of a good friend of mine. But otherwise, it was going to the places and allowing memories to try to come back. In many cases, absolutely correcting memory, because I had one view. I could have drawn out a map on the way that it looked, and I got there, and nah, not at all.
Totally different.
Not at all. Radically different. The place that I joined the Navy out of, my dad, we were living in basically a cottage or like a tiny house, because finances were what they were at the time. I have this very vivid memory of this super just rich green oak tree right at the corner of the driveway. And that was the epitome of green in my memories. And I now live in Maryland. I understand what green is living in Maryland. So I go back.
It's a different kind of green, though, I bet.
Yes. So I go back and I'm like, this is like, meh, a marginal oak tree, and it's not really green, not really lush, but that was the calibration of my mind at the time with what green was like. It was remarkable to go back, and I went alone. It was just a time of really being in place and letting whatever memories come, and I did a bunch of things to prepare myself for it. But I hadn't been back there since. And as I talk with people who either around their hometowns or spend time with high school friends, and they've been friends all these years, and they're like, it's just a completely different experience for me.
Yeah.
And so there's a form of jealousy, or just, I know that I missed out by moving away. And there's been a bunch of glorious things. It's been a full life. But those connections, they're just not there. And so it's fun to read a work like this, or to hear some of the stories of what carrying this sense of place forward has done for yourself or others.
One of my reviewers said something to the effect of me glorifying or putting my grandmother on a pedestal. And that was probably not an incorrect review, because I don't know, when you lose people, especially if it's a parent or a child, somehow all the bad things, they fade away. And it's all the wonderful moments float to the top. And so my grandmother was not a book of all wonderful moments. She had her moments. We're all flawed individuals in some way. But I wanted to, when people die, we honor. We pay tribute. We have a celebration of their life. I think I've heard people say, if you don't have anything good to say at a funeral, don't say anything at all. But there were so many, you hear people say, talk about scales and weighing the good with the bad. And I think writing poems about people and places, because I could totally look back on Cortland as some racist place. Most people who are from the city have no desire to live in the South. I went to school with a lot of my roommates were from the North. They were from Maryland or DC. And like, I used to have no desire to venture into Mississippi, because everything we heard about Mississippi, Alabama, the Deep South was not good for African Americans. But I have some great friends who live and came from those states, and they love to go home. And people may have thought that way about Cortland. Probably one of the only reasons my husband and I are not living in Southampton County today is because we like to be near really good hospitals.
That is a nice park.
It's a rural town. We did not go back home because we didn't like home. Of course, when you go home, there are a lot of positives to living in the country. We're just an hour away from Cortland right now. I can go to Cortland anytime I feel like it. But I guess the idea is that once you step back and you look at the place, even though a lot of horrible things happened in Cortland, in Southampton County, even I'm talking about in history and how that history trickles down. You take something like slavery and the Nat Turner slave revolt and people's notions of that and people's notions of race. My cousin was the first Black sheriff in the town. He's sheriff now. That just happened in the last couple of years. So when you think about these small towns and how race is set up, I think racism is a reason to not want to live in a place. It is. I think it's a good reason because a lot of times you don't want your children to experience the life that you experienced. But I was thinking about what you said in terms of you said you feel like you missed out because you didn't have those connections. My husband and I had those connections, but when I look at the lives of our three sons, how we moved 8 times, how they went to 2 different high schools, they never really got to finish high school with the people they started kindergarten with, like us. I've actually had these conversations with them about if they thought they missed out on something, but their response is, maybe it's because they're these new millennials, Gen Z types, but their response was that they think the experience made them more resilient and more adaptable.
Yeah.
I think that applies to us as well. You served in the Navy and we moved with the Army. It definitely makes you a little bit more adaptable because we had to be, whether you wanted to or not. When it was time for PCS or move, you had to move. And the funny thing about it is my husband retired in 2023 and I like the military moving. I got used to moving every 2 to 3 years, as long as we stayed in a place for 6 years. And that was here about 10 years ago. We did a couple different assignments because my grandmother was dying. And so we took another assignment. But once we retired, I was like, I'm ready to move again. So some of us like it. Some of us like that moving about, meeting new people. They become old people and then you're ready to move again and meet other new people. And so I don't know that I've learned to not feel like I missed something. Remember, I talked about complaining and venting. One of the things that my husband would hear me say a lot is, I've been following you around in the military for 20 years. I've not had a chance to really do what I want to do. And I'm sure many military spouses do that and maybe kids. And I never imagined that at the end of his retirement that I would get to do what I wanted to do. I've been at Virginia State for 8 years and I'm kind of working in the flow of things the way I've always wanted to. And again, there's that question that leads us back to that question of power. When we came back here, I had been teaching 20 years with a master's degree and I taught everywhere the military sent us. And I had started a PhD program in 2009, but he got sent to Korea. And I was like, there's no way I'm finishing a PhD program with 3 children by myself. So I got out of the program and then I just gave up on that. But we came back here and I ended back in a doctoral program at Virginia State University. And there were moments when I wanted to give up because I was working on that degree full-time faculty member. I had a family, I had children, and it was tough. And it ended during COVID. And so, but again, there's that voice. You want it to do. This is something you really want to do. Stick it through. Finish it. It'll pay off when you really don't know if it's going to pay off. Education is so expensive now, but it did pay off. And so that has been the story of my life. You're at this crossroads. What decision do I make? Which way do I go? And I think I've always been led innately to make the right decision. And I've always been surrounded by people who give me good advice. I listen to people who give me good advice. And that's been a lot of people. Those people show up in this book. Mm. And so in the dedication, I dedicate the book to my grandparents and all of my grandparents but not just my grandparents, my husband's family as well, because I've known my husband since the sixth grade. We started dating when I was a 10th grader. So we just celebrated our 30th wedding anniversary on the 29th of July.
Oh, congratulations. We dated
for 7 years. So we've been together 37 years, longer than we've been, than we're in our 50s. So we've been married and we've been together like longer. And so his family has been my family and my family has been his family, but I'm paying homage to all these people. So even though there's the feeling of his grandparents and his family in this book, we have our own individual stories, but we come from the same place. And I think that's probably what's helped us to stay together so long. The foundation was the same. It was similar. Our parents are different, but we are the sum total of all these people and this place, Cortland. So it's very special to us, Southampton County, even though it has its history and it has its issues like everywhere else. But it's a special place because we know that our roots are there. And that question why, we were born into these families in that time for a particular reason. And I think my husband posted on our anniversary a stanza from an unknown poem, but it talked about how God brought two people together with our differences, our talents, all the different things that we do, but yet we came together and we successfully not only exist, but we support each other. And so when you know that question, do you feel responsible? Do you feel responsible to your race? I feel responsible not just to my race, but also to humanity, to mankind. And so for our anniversaries, people always say, oh, you guys are a power couple or you're such a great couple. We take pride in who we are as married people. And we try to set an example even in our marriage that people are watching. It goes back to people are watching. Not only are our sons watching how we do marriage, but other people are watching. I love marriage and I know it doesn't always work out for everybody. I wish it could. I wish it could because I think particularly in the Black community, I think that what happens with families in the Black communities, it hurts us. It hurts us. We have a lot of, used to be, we had a lot of fathers who were incarcerated. We have mothers incarcerated. And so when I teach my college students, I left Southampton County and I went to UVA, which is a predominantly white university. Here I was, this young, poor African-American girl who was there. And I was surrounded by kids who were from all different backgrounds, all different socioeconomic statuses. But when I look at the students that I teach, and they come from various backgrounds as well. Some of them come from two-earner households. Some of them come from affluent families. Some of them come from struggling families. But many of them will share that they didn't have that family growing up. They lived from foster home to foster home.
Wow.
Or a parent is incarcerated. And not only that, it's heartbreaking to watch. I know people lose their parents as a young person. But I have college kids who have parents in hospice. And they're trying to do school and they're trying to take care of parents. And I've had at least three of those in the last year.
Wow.
And when I watch students working at school and at a job and trying to do that, it's hard. And so when I look back, even though my circumstances were what they were. When I went to college, I didn't know how much money my grandparents made. And this was 1995. And I remember going to the financial aid office in 1995 because I had to go take their 1040 in there for income verification for me to get my financial aid. And I remember opening up the envelope because our tax preparer had given it to me in an envelope. And when I saw that my grandparents together were making $28,000 in 1995,
wow.
I literally cried walking to the financial aid office because I'm like, here are two people. When I look at their history, my grandmother was literally orphaned because her mother passed away when she was very young, like a toddler, baby. And then she went to live with her uncle and his family. And then she had the tools of being able to cook and keep house. So she's working in white families' homes. She connects with my grandfather because that's her way out of that house. They move into a house with a man who is very ill. And my grandmother takes care of him. So the man leaves her his house. And that's where they grew. And that house went through several different restructurings and additions. And that's the house that I grew up in. Okay. So initially that was a 4-bedroom house. When it was a 2-bedroom house when they first got married, and gosh, this is like probably like the 50s. And then it was 4. And then the house that I knew was so different from the one they first moved in. But when I looked at that 1040 and saw that they together made $28,000 and that they had supported me, and here I was being able to attend probably one of the best universities in our state and nation, it was sad, but I saw the struggle. And when I even think that I want to give up, I can't. Because people like this put their life on the line so that I could have better opportunities. And so those are the moments where when you ask yourself, what am I doing here? I'm standing on other people's shoulders. And so I don't want to squander the opportunities that people gave me.
It seems that what you're highlighting, and we've touched on it multiple times here, is just the importance of memory and embracing whatever that memory is, all of it.
Yeah. I think because, I say in one of the poems, I don't ever want to forget. I don't ever want to forget the blessing that they were to me. And the poem goes on to say other things. But I don't want to ever forget that, because I think that when you say memory, I think that in forgetting these people, I feel like there's some dishonor in that. To forget the bridge that you came over on. And there's a poem near the end of the book where I say, I don't want to ever forget your strong hands or the sacrifices that you made. I don't want to forget those things. The food. And thinking about religion, there's a short haiku in the book. It's titled Sundays. And it reads, Sundays stayed holy, singing, cooking, worshiping God and those black hands. And I think that haiku came about because I read somewhere, it might have been on social media, where someone was talking about God. And they were like, God to some people is the people who got them over, or the people who really sacrificed all for them. And so some people might say that in this book, I tend to glorify my grandmother or these grandparents. But when I think about the choices that they made, some of the choices that they made were not choices that I would likely make. Like right now, I don't know that I could take in all those children and raise them. That's a very selfless thing to do. And so I think sometimes we take for granted the wonderful things about people and the everyday things that they do. I remember saying at my grandmother's funeral, raise your own kids, because my Shirley Williams has left the building, because my grandma would literally take anybody's kid in and help them. But that's not my ministry. That's not my calling. But that was certainly hers. There was some strength and power in who she was and who they were. My grandfather, I don't talk about him a lot in the book, but he taught me so much. My grandfather was a contractor. And the same way that my grandmother worked in these homes cooking and cleaning, my grandfather worked in the homes of white people who lived around us, but he worked their farms. And so I can remember being 4 and 5, and he would take me on the tractor with him to Mr. Pete Ballard's farm, who was up the road. And so I have all of these wonderful memories, you know, about him. And a lot of the things that I know and can do, I wear a lot of hats. I can fix a lot of things. And I'm pretty much a self-sustaining black woman. But a lot of what I learned from my grandfather, just watching him, because he allowed me to be around. He allowed me to be in the garden. When I was very little, he allowed me to drop seeds in the holes when we were planting. So I have all of those wonderful memories of growing up. And those are rich memories, because a lot of people don't have those. A lot of people just don't have those kinds of memories of home and family, very humble beginnings. But it was one of those situations where you didn't even know you were poor. You didn't even know you were poor until you got out of that environment and you saw what the rest of the world was doing. And how fortunate I was that here were these two people who made less than $30,000 a year. And I always had the best. I was that kid that everybody loved. My other grandmother, who lived just down the street, my whole family was very integral in supporting me. And so I'm just very fortunate to have had all of them. And so in upcoming books, I will write more about my other grandmother. They were very different, but rich in character and happenings and circumstances. But these are the things that Toni Morrison novels were made of. And so in these poems, there's also that idea that we all have a story to tell and we should find ways to tell it, whether it's art, poetry, novels, whatever it is, tell those stories, pay tribute to those people. And I'm sure you, in the work that you do, because you've been talking about home as well, bringing that memory to the forefront, I think is important.
Yes. Over the last little bit less than a decade, there's been a lot of undoing, rebuilding, looking, and asking questions that I didn't dare to ask before. So there's been an interesting journey on my end. Yeah, because for nearly five decades, I wouldn't ask the questions. And now I'm getting a chance, or now I'm doing that. And it's painful, but necessary and beautiful on the other end. Mm-hmm. So this has been, a remarkable thing.
And one of the poems in the book, I'm thinking about what you said about my poems really capturing more than just about race in there. There's a single poem in the book that I always thought kept this manuscript when I was shopping it around from getting noticed. And the poem in the book, because we talk about my grandmother and we talk about her being, she was this great individual to me and a lot of other people. She had her flaws. And so one of the poems in the book is titled Abominations. And I don't know if it's a standout or, but it reads, Mama said this about bull daggers. There was shame and scandal, something to carry down in history. She'd grab my little hand, hurry on by the lesbianism. Somehow I'd inhale it, get it in my central nervous system and die. That poem sticks out, but every time I read it, it's so real because I remember being 5, 6, 7 and learning about, I don't even know that I was learning about homosexuality, but it was, that's a memory that I have. Yeah. And just because we are where we are now, I refuse to leave that poem out of this book. And so for a long time, talking about questions, I wondered whether this question, a lot of my friends in the poetry and writing scene are gay, but I often wondered if this question or if this poem was offending gay people, because that's clearly not the intent. But yeah, this poem to offend gay people, this was an experience that I lived. And I wanted to kind of chronologically put it in this book. Because if I'm writing about my grandmother, and I like truth, I believe you got to be true to yourself. Shakespeare said it, to thine own self be true. But this is also a side of her. But it's not just a side of her. It speaks to how people viewed homosexuality at the time, or gay people. Yes. This was the 70s.
Yeah.
So I think I like this poem because it's short. It gives that Lucille Clifton-ness. Because Lucille Clifton wrote some amazing short poems that pack everything into a little poem. But I like this poem because it allows us to have a conversation about homosexuality and how our elders saw it and how that was projected on us. And that's how I saw it. That's how I saw my grandmother reacting to gay people. And in getting this book out there and getting this manuscript out, I also thought, oh, this poem might be, I don't know if it's offensive. But I never asked not a single one of my gay friends if they found the poem offensive. I never asked. Because part of me about being a writer is I don't care what other people think. I don't think you can be the best writer. I don't think you can write what you want if you're constantly worried about what everybody else is going to think about it. Just write it. Some poems that you write, you're feeling it in that moment. 20 years from now, you may not even be feeling that way. But that's one of the advice, that piece of advice that I give to other people. Don't worry about what everybody else is going to think. This is you. Just be genuine you. And if they don't like it, they don't like it. But I remember when I was pulling this book together and it won the Permafrost Prize in 2023, University of Alaska. And I started working with University Press of Colorado because they were putting it together. And I remember thinking, I need someone to write a foreword. I need an introduction to this book. And I had wanted to ask Sonia Sanchez. Nikki was ill, and so I was not going to ask Nikki. And I was in a program with Sonia Sanchez virtually. And I remember asking a friend of Sonia's, I would really like to get Sonia to write something about this book. And she said, you know what? You don't need to get Sonia. She said, Sonia's an older poet. She said, honestly, I think you should get a young, new poet to write your foreword. And I was like, I hadn't thought of that. I've been self-publishing for 20 years, but I wanted to do something different with this book. I wanted to do it a different way. And when she said that, I was like, I got the perfect person. I was thinking Ariana Benson. She is this amazing up-and-coming poet. She won the Cave Canem Poetry Prize. In fact, she beat me. Her book beat my book. Her book is Black Pastoral, and I love it. I love her work. And we had the chance to meet at the Phyllis Wheatley Festival. And then we had a chance to meet at AWP. And we had developed this. She's also from Virginia, Ariana Benson. She's from Chesapeake, okay. Virginia. But even in asking Ariana to do, and Ariana doesn't know this because we never had this conversation. Ariana is a gay poet. She's in the gay community. Mm-hmm. And when I asked her to write the introduction, I did think, oh my gosh, what is Ariana going to think of this poem?
I can understand that.
I don't want to offend her. But I think people are not that shallow to understand that it's my work, it's my experience. And I don't think there's the intent in the poem to offend. I think it's just telling a story. And poets and creatives know that. And so I was like this, waiting for Ariana to give me, she was getting ready to take a job at Spelman University where she graduated from. And she's, I think I can do it. And I'm like, thank you just for saying yes. But I was still like this when I was waiting to hear her response. And you read the introduction. You read her introduction.
Yeah.
It is absolutely, just reading it, I got teary-eyed when she sent me that introduction because I don't know Ariana well enough. All that I know about Ariana is what goes into a 50-word bio. She's Ariana gotcha. Benson. Yep. She won this. She's a eco poet from Virginia. She's LGBTQIA. That's all I know. But she read these poems and she poured her heart into that introduction. But more so, it resonated. I remember when she gave it back to me, she said, I cannot wait for my mother to read these poems. And so that is the response that I've been getting. I've been hearing from people that they're reading it. They're rereading it to try to understand some of the things. Most of the people that I know have similar upbringings, but I just woke up this morning and Lauren Elaine, who is the director of Fierce Flower now at JMU, she had a picture. She's like, I got the book. So I'm excited all the time when people get it and they're reading it and they're talking about the poems. And so thank you for getting it and reading it in such a short time.
Absolutely. Yes.
But that is the hope for this book, is to tell this story. I have not written a novel yet. I've written short creative essays, and I would love to, but I think I need more time, more patience, and more of a sound attention span to write a novel. Poetry works for me.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Clearly. And yes, you keep putting out amazing work. Yeah. I guess there's a decision to make to deviate from what works and what's bringing you joy and the rest. But at the same time, it is working for you.
Now, you know, I did deviate. You mentioned the missed education of the Negro.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's where you wanted to go or talk about or mention it, but that was a deviation.
no doubt a significant deviation of time and effort and the like. All right, let's do that. And then I'll come back with something that I want to touch on.
Okay.
So how did questions work in that research for you? How were they a part of your journey in doing that research?
Man, the research, anybody who's ever worked on a thesis or PhD, the professors make you have these questions that drive the research. And I guess I can say this, the whole reason I did the research on this topic was because of this whole upbringing in Cortland. I remember growing up, most all of the people that I knew had gone to Riverview High School, but there was something about them. They acted differently. They were, I don't know, Black people on another level. They spoke well. They dressed well. It was the way they carried themselves. And so I used to wonder, what is it about that school that made them, they were just different. And of course, as I went to college and I got to see the differences between the different types of educations, and I had always wanted to research that group. So I ended up in this doctoral program And I'm thinking there's got to be a way for me to pour research into this area. And one of my professors had done research on freedom schools down in the South, the 60s, through all of that. And I wanted to talk about segregated education, and I wanted to use Riverview High, where I grew up, as a focal point or interview that population. But the questions that I had was, being an educator for over 20 years, seeing how students have changed and seeing how Black students, we talk about asking that question, do you feel responsible for your race? Seeing how we have changed as African-American students, our children, I wanted to go back and research that era. And so some of the research questions that I had were, one, what did Black educators do? What did they do in those classrooms to motivate African-American students through Jim Crow? That was, I wanted to know. And then there were questions that led to culture. Were they providing culturally relevant teaching? Was that a key? Wanted to find that out, which some of these questions I felt I already knew the answer to, but it was a research project. And then one of the other questions was, what can we learn from that era? What can we learn from the students? What can we learn from the teachers? What can we learn from this totally Black, segregated education experience to transfer into the now in terms of pouring into not just African-American students, but all of our students?
Absolutely.
So those were the questions that drove that research. The pedagogy, what the students thought of those teachers, what were they doing? How was it culturally relevant? And then how can we use that now? So those were three questions that drove that research. Those were the three. And what I found out, I interviewed 16 people who had graduated from Riverview High School up to the 70s, to when that school was no more because of integration. And in fact, the oldest member that I interviewed, she just transitioned this week. My husband went to her funeral yesterday. But she talked about being in that school. And even though they were there at different times and graduated in different classes, the resounding truth that came from that research was our teachers, our Black teachers, treated us like they loved us. We knew they loved us. We felt safe in that school. We felt safe in that space. The teachers were an extension of family. These were people that they often saw at church or in the community. If they weren't doing something right, a teacher would pay a visit to your home and talk to your parents. If you were having a hard time because your family was a farming family, because many students who were in farming families, you had to work the farm. A lot of times you didn't get to go to school. So we had students who were missing tests, missing events. One of the stories that I recalled was when the star football player, the school was going to play for the championship, and the star football player was not coming because he had to work the farm. So the student that I interviewed reported that the coach took the entire team to that student's house to help with that farm work so that he could be able to go to the game. And they won the championship.
Wow.
That's just one of the stories. One of my other favorite stories to tell from the book is where we want to take a deep dive into the racism of the time. One of the students was one of a lot of children. He had maybe 10, 11 siblings. And they were, you get sharecroppers in this book. They were sharecropping. They were living on somebody else's land. And the white man who owned the land told his father, I want your sons to work the farm. And his father told the owner, my sons are not going to work the farm. They're going to go to school and get educated. Because his father would not allow them to work on that farm, the owner put them out. They had to go find someplace else to live. And the family that replaced them on that farm, they had a lot of children as well. And those children ended up working that farm for that farmer. And only one of those children graduated from high school. And that was the very youngest one. And the individual that I interviewed, he said, had my father not valued education, that could have been me. That could have been me and all of my siblings. And there's racism in that. There's poverty in that. There's everything in that. But these 16 people, and I only was able to interview just a small subset, but every single one of them had a different story to tell. So in that book, The Missed Education of the Negro, it's really, you're getting my whole dissertation, my whole study there. But in chapter four is where these stories unfold. And I will probably publish just that chapter alone, because beyond that book, I was awarded a Virginia Humanities Fellowship to collect more stories, because I love hearing those stories from Jim Crow in my area. So with the Virginia Humanities Fellowship, I was able to expand it, the research area. I interviewed people from all over Virginia. So I got people from Suffolk. I have people from Emporia. I had people from Newport News, Hampton. And just to hear the different stories, it really breaks your heart. But when you see that these people were able to not succumb to the racism, to live through it, and not just live through it, they succeeded. Most of these people went on to do amazing things. I interviewed a GS-15 who had worked her way all the way up in the government. I've interviewed military folk, educators. Some of them have PhDs. Some of them are pastors. They were able to, in the face of all of that adversity and all of that chaos of Jim Crow, and you're talking about racism on top of poverty for many of them, colorism, being denied access and entry into these spaces, I think our young people can learn from that, because our young people today have their fair share of things that they have to overcome. The racism is different. The poverty is different, but it's there. There's so many other issues right now with our children, and to include all of that. So I always say that for many young people today, like, the problems are compounded. I feel like it's a Rubik's Cube. You turn this way, you got another problem. You turn this way, there's another problem. And then you add technology and all the distractions. And it's a wonder that our children are, many of them, able to function. And I see it. I see the struggle. I see the struggle to concentrate. I see the struggle to exist. I see it in students that I teach. And it's getting worse year by year. Mm. But I first started teaching in 98. It wasn't the way it was now. And here we are in 2025. And I feel like the issues are just, sometimes it's too much. Yeah. But if we look at history, and if we need a reason or a story that helps us through it. My grandparents were not formally educated. They didn't go to college. But I always look to other people in the community as role models in different ways. And so I followed those. And so I like being able to share these stories, whether it's in poems or the research. Because what it tells the students is, you're not the first to go through this. And hopefully it gives them some hope and inspiration to push and press on. Because we talk about pushing and pressing on from those hard questions.
Yeah.
Many of today's kids don't have the resilience. Depression and anxiety, it's taken them over. Suicide is taking them over. And we've got to find ways to make them stronger, to make them more resilient. It would be great to not have things happen, but things have been happening in life since the beginning of time. And they are compounded now, but we've got to find a way to make our young people a little bit more resilient. And I think knowing history, not just your own, but just knowing history and how you fit into that. So here was little bitty me, born in Southampton County. And that was my world. Cortland was my world. Yeah. And then Virginia became my world the more I grew. I was thinking about 1991. I was coming out of high school. I was that kid who was involved in everything. Wavy TV 10 selected me as the Young Achiever of the Year for all of Hampton Roads. And so that was mind-blowing for me, to be this little girl who came out of this little town, and then that happened. Then I go to UVA, and then I go to Tech, and then I'm a military spouse, and I'm writing books on my own for 20 years. And everywhere we've been, I've shared my work. I've gone into schools. I've done poetry readings. I've done writing workshops. I do a lot of public speaking in churches and schools. Anywhere people invite me, I go. Hmm. And so I always tell people, if I made it, so can you.
That's a beautiful encouragement. Yeah, I'm very aware right now of a lot of the class things that are driving just on the socioeconomic front, and with some recent trips and funerals and things like that. I'm just so aware. And even in, I did a drive back from Connecticut today, back to the DC area. Mm-hmm. and even in stopping in some of the towns just to get coffee or get a bite to eat, and just seeing what's happening and just witnessing others, not seeking to judge, but just to witness,
right,
and seeing struggles that are happening, just very aware of this and wanting to be able to encourage folks. And it's like human thriving. That's where we need to be going after. All of this other stuff is just, it's, yeah, a tragedy. It's a waste.
Yeah. This is demanding work. And I know that you do it. I know that you do it. I knew that right away when I met you, that you're into this work. And so I love meeting people who are into this kind of work. And I've taught all over. I've taught in Texas. I've taught in North Carolina. I've taught in North Chicago. But now that I have a responsibility as a Black person and I'm whatever, but now that I'm in this HBCU space where most of my students are of color, I also feel the responsibility to help them understand, because one of the things that I learned growing up in the Black community is sometimes we focus on our own problems because our problems are many. But I try to teach also that the problems that we experience are beyond the Black community. There's other people who experience these issues too. And so we do have a small number of students who are not Black at Virginia State University. And many of those students that we serve, they have the same problems. I remember teaching at another small university, and there were a lot of African-American students. And it had one white female. And she said, "I just want you guys to know that I've had all the same problems that you all have had." She was like, "Bored, a drug, it's just a myriad of things." And I think that is also important for us to know and understand, because sometimes life will have you thinking it's just you. It's something about that bird's eye view. You can't see the rest of the world if you're just in your own space. Like, I teach students who come from, I have students sometimes that come from New York and they live in these areas, and they'll say, "Dr. Faison, you, I could go without seeing a white person like for months based on where they live." And I think about where I grew up. We were mixed. You might as well say it was the same experience. We were mixed at school, but we weren't mixed anyplace else. And yeah. So when you think about the kinds of lived experiences that people have, that kind of shapes what you think about race. And if that's the experience that's the only experience you're going to have your whole life, it says a lot. So I always tell the students that I teach, get to know other people, get to know the students from the city, get to know the students from the islands, get to know students who have different faith than you.
Yeah.
Get to know students who don't like what you like. Get to know the quiet students, because in getting to know these other people, you get to hear their stories and what shaped them and what made them. And you'll see that you're different, but you also have some things in common. I mean, it's almost like being able to travel without going anywhere.
Yeah.
When you meet a new person. And you'll see young kids when I got to UVA, I was not shy. I remember there was a kid from Turkey named Alper. And Alper used to come to our room and talk about everything. And we loved it. We like really wanted to meet and mingle with other students and learn about their cultures and just everything about their life. And they also wanted to learn about ours. My roommate grew up in DC and I grew up in the country. And so we were different. But we're still friends to this day. All of my friends from college were in my wedding. And I was the first one to get married, of course. But there's something to be said about diversity. And to see what's happening with diversity, equity, and inclusion right now in this country, it's a tragedy. Because there really is beauty in that. There's power in diversity. And to think that we have not just people, but that we have leaders who don't value that. It's scary. What we're experiencing is scary.
It really is.
Like a horror movie where nobody really knows what to do. People are doing things, but it seems to be like not enough. And I know older people who are just feeling hopeless right now, that their children and grandchildren are about to inherit a world that we all thought we had put to bed.
Yeah.
This Jim Crow that I talk about in some of my poems and in my research, this seems to be the place that these folk are trying to have us revisit. And it's very scary, to say the least.
Yeah. Yes, it is. And so there's, I realize I'm talking with a doctor here, and I'm going to bring up a reference that probably is not in any of your research that you've used for professional work, but
okay.
In the hotel room last night, we watched a little bit of Indiana Jones. So,
hey, I like Indiana Jones.
This is the Crystal Skull one where, but in any event, this was, it's got me thinking about just the long arc of history. And I also saw a video clip from Joshua Doss, who's an amazing guy. He does polling and such. And he was talking about how in 25 or 30 years, you won't be able to find, no one will confess to being a MAGA person, because all of this stuff will be revealed. And then it's like people go, oh, back, those were crazy days.
That is not cool.
So that, the combination of Joshua Doss's comments, because he referred back to posts, like he did a couple examples, but like Martin Luther King Jr. It's like, okay, great. After Martin Luther King Jr. was murdered, and then a couple decades later, it was like, he is this great man. In his day, he was hated. But then there's this shift that happens. Then same kind of thing with before the civil rights movement, where because people were lynched up until 1970 or 72 is the last lynching. So as we look back at that time, people would go to picnics and watch these murders happen.
Yeah.
All of those people, they're grandparents now that were sitting on the blankets.
Yeah.
So they didn't go anywhere. But today, if you go talk with, if you found some of these grandparents that are bouncing their grandkids on their knee and you talk to them about it, I doubt that they're have it on their resume that this is what they did as kids.
Yeah.
So it's the distancing. So I think that we're probably going to see something like that eventually with the MAGA crowd and the things that are going on. Because I just saw that Smithsonian pulled down Trump as someone who was impeached because he didn't like that. Yeah. And it's the truth is going to come back and be presented. You can't hide from it. And then back to the Indiana Jones thing where it's like a long time can go on and like literally Trump's name is not going to be remembered for forever.
Yeah.
For even all the power and the bluster and the damage that is happening, it'll get forgotten.
No one thinks highly of dictators.
No.
And that's who he is. I once said that, and this was before his reelection, I had said that I felt like everything in this country would have to be undone and started again. I'm talking about the education system, the health system, even our constitution on how it was constructed. But that seems to be what's going on. That seems to be where we are. I don't think that's his intent. His intent is to do some other things. But yeah. I feel like when thinking about supernaturally and how things like naturally happen, I feel like this is the great undoing of everything. And I feel like we're gonna get to ground zero at some point. I wish it were tomorrow, but I feel like at some point we're going to get to ground zero and then we're just going to have to rebuild back up. And when we rebuild, we will do it even better than we did before. That is the hope that I have. And sometimes people say it's hard to have hope, but I do have hope, even though it's ugly, what we're seeing, what we're witnessing, what we're experiencing. But I do have hope that when we get to ground zero, it's just what is ground zero going to look like? Who's going to even be here anymore? And it's going to be a lot of work, but I think we will get to ground zero soon. I hope we get there
sooner rather than later. Yes.
Yeah.
On a happier note, I do want to ask you, what has the Wintergreen Women's Writers Collective meant to you?
Oh, man. Okay, if you're going to ask me that, I have to tell the story.
Bring it on.
I have to tell the story. So let's talk about, again, how we met.
That's my joy. Okay.
So all of my life, I self-published my first poetry book probably in 99 or 2000. And so as a military spouse who's living all these different places, I'm raising children, I'm writing in silo and publishing my own work, but I'm networking with people, thank God, because of the internet. When I think about AI now, the internet allowed me to meet so many people without really meeting them in person. So I had a writing community, but I had heard of Furious Flower and Kaveh Khanum, but I never was able to get to any of the events. Always wanted to go. And then there was the passing of Amiri Baraka and the passing of Maya Angelou, the passing of Toni Morrison. And I was not able to be kind of here for those sorts of moments. And so my husband gets stationed back. We come from overseas in 2014. We're in Northern Virginia. And I always said, when I get back home, I'm going to a Furious Flower conference. It's the Poetry Center at JMU. So 2019, they're doing a Living Legacy Seminar for Nikki Giovanni. And I love her. She's one of my favorites. And so I apply because I'm teaching at an HBCU. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to apply. They had these nice fellowships. So I apply. I get the fellowship. I get to go to JMU and be there studying Nikki with Nikki all week. There's a blog post about this on my website. Spending that week with Nikki. Spending that week with Nikki is how I was introduced to the Wintergreen Women. The Wintergreen Women did a panel, I want to say toward the end of that week. And I remembered it was Val Gray Ward. It was Dr. Trudier Harris, Dr. Mary Emma Graham, Joanne Gavin, of course, Dr. Gavin. And so I'm like, these women are phenomenal. Because when you go to these conferences, a lot of times the research and the presenters can be contemporary. But because of the way I grew up, I was raised by my grandparents. I love older people. I just love older people. Sometimes me and my husband think we were born in the wrong era because we really like hanging out with people who are older than us. And so when I met this group of women, of course, I was fascinated by them. I hadn't heard of any of them except Nikki and Dr. Gavin. And so the story about how they came to be, the group was founded for Nikki when she came to Virginia Tech. Joanne Gavin brought this group of Black writers together to surround her and be her network here in Virginia since she was coming from Cincinnati or Ohio. And so that's how I met Wintergreen. And I remember almost all of the young people there, a lot of young poets, writers, and educators, they were like, how can we get into Wintergreen? And I remember they were like, oh, you guys should go out and start your own writers groups and things of that nature. Because it was like, that's their group. That was their thing. But I remember, so that was 2019. It was either 2020. Furious Flower had its 25th anniversary gala in DC. And I went up for the gala. Not only did I go, I took my husband, my son, and I took about four students. I think it was four students from Virginia State. And that was an amazing weekend. Amanda Gorman was there. She at that moment, we didn't know her as the inaugural poet. She was like sort of some youth poet or whatever, but she was there. She was amazing. And the entire gala was nice. But the last evening of the gala ended up with a reading of some of the top 50 poets, I would say, top 50 Black poets in the nation. And that happened at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. So I was just like mesmerized and in awe. And we come home and I'm kind of on this high, like from 2019, the Nikki seminars, and then there's this. And of course it's inspiring. It's always when writers get together, it's like church. That's the only way I can explain it. We love to be together. Nobody cares who anybody is. You just love to be together, right? I was like, wow, this is amazing, this community. So my plan was to participate in anything I could. But 2021, I think, was the year where Dr. Gavin sent me an invitation. She sent me an invitation and invited me to the next Wintergreen retreat. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, wow. I couldn't believe it. Here I am about to enter a group of women who have taught while I was in college. And so I was knocked off my feet. And that first one, that invitation came in COVID, in the midst of COVID. So the first retreat that I experienced with Wintergreen, we weren't even able to get together because the Wintergreen women, like the way the group started, they started meeting at Wintergreen in the mountains.
Yeah.
And they would go to the cabin and have their retreat in summers. I think they did a couple of other retreats in different locations. But so I was honored. And I remember all of the young ladies who were invited in along with me that year, we were all just honored. And so we did our first meeting virtually. But to be sitting virtually in the space with Nikki, with Sonia Sanchez, with all these women, it was powerful. I think Rita Dove even. Rita Dove was teaching at UVA when I was there, but I never had the opportunity to take any of her courses. I didn't take any courses with Nikki, but I did get a chance to have a sit down with Nikki per Jenny, per her wife. I don't know if they were married then, but Jenny was my professor.
Okay.
I loved her work and I loved her courses. And once I found out she and Nikki were friends, they were more than friends probably, but I asked her to get me a meeting with Nikki and she did. And that meeting changed my life. Because that meeting with Nikki was what prompted me to self-publish. Nikki had me in her office and she loved to have her coffee in her thermos and we drank coffee. But I literally, and she was just so open and nice. I pretty much asked her how she got started. And of course, if you read, but she shared with me that she was writing these poems during the civil rights movement. And she talked about actually following people like Dr. King around to the different events and doing poetry. And how eventually they begin to ask her to do poems at these civil rights events. And then she self-published her own first book and sold it out of the trunk of her Volkswagen. And then she, I think that year, her book, Collected Poems, had come out, which I have here. Collected Poems had come out. And what made it real to me, self-publishing, was she said, people think I'm making a lot of money off of this book, but I only get 10 cents off of every dollar. And that was an eye-opener. And so I always attribute that meeting with Nikki in her office as what really, that before I left Virginia Tech, I had several poems published in Virginia Tech magazines. And so that just shows you how inspired I was there as a graduate student. And I had my first poems published in literary magazines on the campus of Virginia Tech. And then I reunited with my husband, who we had gotten married, but he was in Korea while I was at Virginia Tech. We reunited, went down to South Carolina. I was there. We had our first son. We moved to Charlotte, North Carolina. He was stationed in Charlotte. And I was pregnant with my second son. And that's where the book started happening, the self-publishing. And I always attribute that meeting with her to pushing me to self-publish. And I met writers who showed me how to do it. I met writers who had self-published, but had gotten these major book contracts elsewhere. There's a writer by the name of J.J. Murray, who lives in, I think, Roanoke.
Okay.
And he was writing multicultural novels at the time. The first one was Renee and Jay, because he's an Italian guy married to a Black woman. And we met online and we just, oh, he was so inspirational. He actually used one of my poems in one of his books as a title. It's called Original Love. And so he opens the book with a poem of mine that he's like reading on a flight. And it's Original Love. And that's the title of the book. So I have met a lot of amazing people along the way. And although I was not connected with, say, Fierce Flower or Wintergreen, even in those years, just like Cortland, just like Southampton County, those years were important to get me to a Fierce Flower or Wintergreen moment. And I always tell people the self-published books got me here to Nursery Rhymes in Black. Without those, I wouldn't get here. But Wintergreen, I love that I've been fortunate enough to be invited into that circle of women who write. We just came off of our retreat. We went to Curie Beach this year. We didn't go to Wintergreen. We went to Curie Beach, North Carolina. Once when I saw you at Tech, the very next day, I believe it was after you and I met, Dr. Gavin asked me if I would be the retreat coordinator. And I accepted. And then I got invited to be on the board for the Wintergreen Writers Collective. So Wintergreen means an absolute lot to me. I count it an honor to be able to be a part of the group, but not only that, to carry on the legacy of the group. Nikki was the reason that group was formed, but Nikki wasn't a selfless person. She loved these women in this group.
Absolutely.
she loved Wintergreen, and Wintergreen loved Nikki. And so we missed her at this year's retreat, and we hope to be able to shower Jenny with love at this year's retreat. And we did. We went back to the June 8th tribute at Virginia Tech. And while we were in retreat, this project was led by one of the Wintergreen sisters named Alicia Dempsey. We put together a quilt for Nikki. So while we were at the retreat, we were downstairs hiding from Jenny, and we were all kind of creating our own little personal patches, decorating them, writing things on them. And Alicia had the vision of taking these patches because Nikki had an amazing poem about quilts. And in that poem, she talks about how when she dies, she hopes that someone will put her in a quilt. And so Alicia Dempsey had the idea to do this project. And I could send you a photo of this after here, but we all did patches and we put them together in a quilt. And in the center was a portrait of Nikki that we all got to paint. It was like a paint by color. And that quilt, we presented it to Jenny we showed it to Jenny at the retreat this year, but it was actually gifted and presented to Jenny after the June 8th memorial tribute at Virginia Tech. Yeah. Wintergreen is amazing. And the women are pretty fantastic.
As a quick aside, or in the conversation with Nikki, she had mentioned the quilts in Appalachia and how they would often be used to help folks escaping to freedom. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to help identify friendly homes and the like. So
yes, Underground Railroad. Those quilts were important. They would hang them across a banner or hang them on the homes, and the stitching, the symbols, the things that were in the quilt would let someone know that this was a safe house.
Yeah.
And I think what made that project of doing this quilt for Nikki even more memorable was one of the Wintergreen sisters who I got to meet at the 2019 seminars, Val Gray Ward. Val passed away before Nikki in March. Val was, she was the founder of the Kumba Theater in Chicago, performed a lot of James Baldwin's and other Black writers' works, so much so that they called her the voice of the Black writer. But she could sing, she could act. And so we got to meet Val at the 2019 seminar. And she and Nikki were very close, so we got to see how important they were to each other. But Val was working on this quilt. When we met her in 2019, she brought her quilt to display as part of the seminar. And it was a huge quilt. And in this quilt were pieces and patches that she had created. Some of them from things that she had from writers like Baldwin or different Maya Angelou, like just different people. And so this quilt, her goal was to get it hanging in the National Museum, but that quilt's been a lot of different places. So yeah, I did a blog post on my first time meeting Wintergreen, and it's on the Nikki Living Legends seminar. And so there's a picture of the quilt with Val and Nikki on that blog post. But so the quilt was just so symbolic, not just because of Nikki's poem and her talking about quilts, but also because of Val. So it was a full circle moment being able to work on that quilt.
Yeah. Multi-layered on, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
That is glorious. Let's see. Going to need to figure out how to land this plane, and I'm not exactly sure how we do that. So I think I'll just make a hard right turn. But I do like to ask folks what their right now question is. So this is the question that you're kind of working with. And this is something beyond what's for dinner at this point, or if you're going to get married, which you've already answered what that looks like, but between the almost mundane and the big questions, what questions are you currently working with right now?
I think the biggest question right now is, what have I gotten myself into as department chair? But that's the story of my life. I end up in these big moments and then I have to stand up at them. It's like, you made it here. It's almost like when you're playing Monopoly and you're working your way around the board. If you're here and now what? I'm going back to thinking about when I was a kid and just seeing myself in Cortland. Like, I have always been the kid who strived for big things. Always. Then when they happen, you're in it and you're like, okay, now what? And so I think having this new book come out, and someone told me at work last week, my dean, she said, it's your time. It's your moment. It's your time. But people have said that to me a lot at different times in my life. And I guess it's when a lot of good things seem to be happening all at once. And I'm enjoying it, but I'm also always questioning. So I love that you open up this interview with a question. I'm always questioning, what do I do next? What matters most in the moment that I'm in now? How can I make the biggest difference? And so that's my question, like right now. It's not, will they like me? Will they help me? It's, what do I do? You know, how do I move in this moment? And that's how I try to live my life. Yeah, how do I live in this moment?
I'm excited for you also just very excited for the students. But in, as you had mentioned, I think this was before we got started, but the having to put your name in the hat and get after this, you had a vision for this particular organization and the students and what's ahead as you go into this next chapter. So I'm excited for you to be able to bring that vision to life.
Yeah. Because usually there's always, when we think about purpose, why am I here? There is a reason. I almost left Virginia State so many times. Academia is hard. Black academia is harder. Because in Black academia, we have to work all the miracles. We have to do everything with little resources, less people. And so there's a lot of work to be done, but I've been here 8 years, and every time I said, I can't do it, I can't stay, there was someone telling me, you got to stay. No, those kids need you. You're meant to be there. And so when I talk about surrounding yourself with the right people, I've never had people to talk me out of my blessings or out of my purpose, because sometimes people can do that. They can talk you out of the space you're supposed to be in. And so even when I throw out these hard things, I called people when I was running for department chair, because I was looking for someone to tell me no. I was looking for someone to say, I wouldn't do it. But even though people had their own hard experiences in this place, I couldn't find a single person. And it suddenly turned into, oh, Latoriel, you can do this. You're good for it. You got to do it. You would do so many great things. And so that has been the story of my life. Even when I wanted to talk myself out of doing something, I'm surrounded by these people who say, what Barack Obama said, yes, you can. Yes, you can. And so I'm living off of yes, you cans. I'm living off of my grandmother's yes, you can. My grandmother always said, you can do anything you put your mind to. Okay. I don't know why parents tell children these things, but we believe them. And like for a good 20 years, I believed my grandmother when she said, you can do anything you put your mind to. Some things we find out cost money. But that is what parents do. That's what people who love you do. And so I'm just thankful that people have seen in me what I believe I came here to do.
Yeah.
And I don't think department chair is the last thing that I'll do. I think there will be other things. Yeah. I'm restless. I'm always looking for the next thing to do. I always tell my husband, when I slow down, I'm probably going to be leaving the earth because it's just not in me to not be. I always want to do something next. There's always something I want to do. I'm not a big traveler. I don't like traveling a lot. I think that's because we move so much in the military with a family of five. So while many of my friends are traipsing off to these amazing places, right now, I'm enjoying home and space and writing and doing what I'm doing and strolling back down memory lane and trying to put these memories and make sense of them and help other people, help students and people that I meet find the value in their own memory and their stories and their history and turn it into something. And so I feel like that's where I am in this moment. And what I'm hoping to do as department chair, we had meeting last week. We're hoping to revamp within our department, a theater program. We have some amazing talent in the department. We have authors and playwrights in this department, dancers at Virginia State who have their own dance companies. And so I'm trying to bring us all together and be at the forefront of taking our department into the 21st century. Yeah.
Sounds like a bold vision. It's a good thing.
It is. But have that poem that you like.
Yes.
If you want, we can go into that.
Yes. Let's go ahead and do that.
The poem that you like was like an ancestor. And this is how it reads. Like an ancestor, we never knew. Your smile shined with southern sun's warmth. Your hands like honeybees were always busy as a city street, quiet as a country road, coming together, making memories and all the good times real. Your lips outlined a kind vernacular. A beauty lived in the lining of your tongue every time we laid eyes and ears on you. You never did grow old. With wisdom, style, and common sense, you gave life. Like oceans bearing in the tide, you came gathering life, giving life, praising God, every day bearing witness to storms, breaking ground, changing climate, whispering secrets to winds, taking everyone with you, leaving us somehow renewed.
That is beautiful.
So many people in that poem. And I see why you like that poem, because anybody can identify with that poem. And I'm not just talking about my grandmother in that poem. It's my grandfather. It's every single person whose path crossed mine. It's my eighth grade teacher in whose class I won my first national writing contest. It's my fourth grade teacher who told the gifted educator leader in our county that I should be tested for our county's gifted program. I'll never forget that. The lady came to the classroom and asked for a single white student. And when my teacher, one of these black teachers who had come out of this segregated education, when she found out, she was like, we have other students who need to be tested. And I was one of them. But because of moments like that, not just me, but other kids were not overlooked. And so in that poem, like an ancestor, that's what I'm leaning on. I'm leaning on all those people who are no longer with us, who were not family, but were like family, who took us in, who fed us, who nurtured us, who encouraged us, who inspired us, who pushed us and told us, yeah, you can go do this. And yeah. Those were the kind of people that I had in my life. Those were the kinds. When my grandmother was not there, somebody else was there. And so that is what students need today. That is what not just students, but that's what everybody needs. Right. You just need someone. Grey's Anatomy was one of my favorite shows. You need somebody who's your person, no matter where you are in whatever situation. And it's sad because there are a lot of people out there without people. There's a lot of people out there who don't have this community, this village that a lot of us had. And talk about writing in silo. There's people out there living and starving right now and drowning in their own anxiety and depression and aloneness. And so I always wish for people that they have a village, that they have somebody. And if that's me, then that's me. Yeah.
That almost sounds like something that your grandmother would say in taking in the neighborhood kids. So they may not be living with you, but
yeah.
You're still carrying on that tradition.
I think I've taken care of a lot of kids without bringing them into my home, because there's more ways than one to take care of a person. Kids need food. They need money. They need clothes. They need counseling. They need resources. They need someone to vouch for them. My husband and I have done all of those sorts of things over the 30 years we've been together. Those are the things that we try to teach our sons, to instill in them. Their lives have been a lot more privileged than ours. But at the end of the day, you want to be good people. You want your children to be good people. And it helps that we came from good people. That's quite a legacy to carry on. And we've been very blessed in the family area, because I have friends right now who don't have family. And though I take for granted having all these people that I'm attached to, I have a friend who lives in South Korea who always reminds me that you're so blessed you have family. And sometimes I'm thinking, oh, these people are getting on my nerves. But then there's her who wishes she had someone. And like, that's life.
Indeed. Just to the point of ancestor, it sounds like you're doing a marvelous job in being the ancestor to those that'll follow and laying the groundwork of creating this community, creating a body of work and seeking to bring about positive change. And so,
yeah, my grandmother often thought about her own mortality. In fact, she talked about dying often, almost sometimes we thought she was obsessed with it. She made sure in one of the poems that I write, I talk about how she had these insurance policies and she paid them. But my grandmother talked about dying because she wanted us to be prepared. And when I look back, I like that because this whole book, Nursery Rhymes in Black, it was born out of grief. And I like that she talked about death often because I've seen death literally terminate people. They don't know how to deal with it. They don't know how to grieve. They don't know how to move on. And because my grandmother talked about death a lot, I talk about death and dying a lot with my own children. You need to know where the insurance policies are. You need to know what to do if something happens to your dad and me. Because if we never have those conversations with kids, I've seen kids who don't know what to do after families, after parents die. And thinking about your question and this poem, like an ancestor, one day I will be an ancestor. And I think a lot about the legacy that I want to leave. And there's a lot when I think about my life. But when I think about my life and me being an ancestor one day, I think about how I read the story of Maya Angelou, how I read Toni Morrison's Bluest Eye or Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. And even as a young person, I could see in the trajectory of their lives, in their work. And so one day I'll be an ancestor, and I hope that young readers or just people in general will look at my life and say, wow, this was a life well lived, even.
Amen.
Lived to the fullest, but that they'll also take some of those qualities that I try to carry out. Yeah.
Sounds like a beautiful plan. Yeah. Life well lived.
We're all going to be ancestors one day.
Indeed.
And I've even thought so far as what I want on my tombstone. In fact, I don't even know. I have a tendency to overdo things. And so there's so many things I want on my tombstone. I joke about this a lot with my kids. I say, I'm going to need a 3-day funeral. They think I'm crazy when I say these things. But I don't know. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah, I was up in Connecticut for a funeral over the last couple of days. And before we... And this is where my wife's family's from. And before we left, we popped around to several different cemeteries and I GPS marked where different family members are. Like literally yesterday, I was walking through a bunch of cemeteries and remembering family.
Cemeteries are not scary for me anymore. I told you my grandmother used to drag me to the funeral home When she passed away, I visited her grave often. She left behind my grandfather. He lived 4 more years, but he had Alzheimer's. So I used to go sit with him on weekends, but he would forget that she was gone. And so a lot of times I would drive him there and we would see the grave and that would remind him that she was there. But cemeteries, I think they're like the great documenters of history. But also obituaries. And I'm finding that people aren't really writing the obituaries out anymore. At least a lot of the people that I'm seeing pass. But I like when my grandmother passed away, she had all of these funeral programs and obituaries. And I hate to even say it, but I had so much fun sitting there reading through them, like people that had died when I was a kid, but they were family members and then connecting the families. Because it's like a little library in itself. So I think that's a tradition that needs to be carried on. In the Black community, I'm seeing less and less obituaries written. I see these little one-liners, so-and-so passed away and this is that. You're not getting like these stories. An obituary, it tells a story. And but I get it. Yeah, that's history.
Yeah.
That's history.
Where is the best place for folks to engage with you and learn more about what you're excited about?
I am on social media. I'm on Facebook. I'm now back on X because of this new book. I wasn't on X, but Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and my books can be found at Amazon and Barnes & Noble online. The new book can be found at University Press of Chicago right from their site. It's available in print. It's available in ebook. But they can literally find me anywhere. Just Google me. I'm at Virginia State University.
Yeah. Excellent. And I will put links in the show notes to all of your works, but also tags to the specific poems that you shared and the like, and all the different resources that we talked through to amplify, highlight, and celebrate. Toriel, thank you so much for sharing about your story of family, your writing, your expertise, and how you've shown up in the world. And thank you for bringing that and coming to two curated questions and amplifying what questions look like in your life. So thank you for being here.
Thank you, Ken. Thanks for just a great time to sit and talk about everything. And thanks for amplifying these stories and our voices. Appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Ken here. This conversation with Dr. Faison was rich in depth and breadth. Understanding the story behind the perpetual tenacity that has delivered many self-published books, earned a trove of accolades, and a doctorate is inspiring. This conversation is part of the continued legacy of poet Nikki Giovanni, who I am so grateful to have had the opportunity to meet and to be in conversation with. Yesterday, I met a listener who enjoyed the Nikki Giovanni conversation and immediately went out to purchase all of Nikki's children's poetry books to read to her daughter. I was deeply moved to hear the conversation that had introduced the newest generation to Nikki's beautiful work. As for this conversation with Dr. Toriel Faison, these are my four takeaways. What resonate with you? Number one, from organizing pain to collective healing. She who loves must learn to organize pain. For Dr. Faison, storytelling, whether through poetry, research, or teaching, became a vessel for transforming suffering into meaning. By arranging personal experiences and inherited grief into a narrative, she not only found healing, but created spaces where communities can confront wounds together. Her collection, Nursery Rhymes in Black, exemplifies this, weaving family memory, cultural history, and honest truth-telling into an offering for collective reflection and restoration. Question: what pain in your life, if shaped into a story, might become a gift of healing for you and perhaps others? Number two, from individual success to ancestral responsibility. Dr. Faison's journey reveals how personal achievement carries collective weight. Raised by grandparents who taught her, "When you go out of this house, you represent us," she learned to see her accomplishments as part of a lineage, honoring sacrifices made before her and creating pathways for those who follow her. Her research on Riverview High School deepened this perspective, uncovering how Black educators fostered resilience and excellence despite systemic barriers. In her work, every milestone becomes an act of gratitude and a step forward for the community. Question: how might your choices change if you genuinely believe you are carrying the hopes of those who came before you and paving the way for those who come after? Number three, from memory and place to power and story. Cortland, Virginia, where Dr. Faison grew up, lives in her writing as both sanctuary and struggle. By revisiting its history, contradictions, and beauty, she shows how places shape us even as we outgrow them. Memory, she reminds us, is more than nostalgia. It's a personal archive and communal inheritance. Through her research, poetry, and teaching, she demonstrates that when we recover and share the stories of where we come from, we create meaning, deepen identity, and invite others into connection and healing. Question: What place from your past still holds untold stories, and how might sharing them illuminate both where you have been and where you are going? Number 4. From asking why me to asking what now? Dr. Faison's life illustrates the evolution of inquiry itself. As a child, she asked, "Why was I born this way, in this place?" Over time, her questions matured into, "How do I move in this moment?" By embracing uncomfortable truths, whether through poems like Abominations or dialogues about race, identity, and belonging, she models how difficult questions deepen community rather than divide it. For her, purpose is discovered not by looking backward for explanations, but by leaning forward into service, creation, and connection. Question: are your questions keeping you tethered to the past, or are they propelling you toward the life and impact you're meant to create? That's it for this episode, so please share what resonated with you. To those on the other side of the speakers, thank you for being here. Gratitude shout out to Beauty Pill for the show's music and producer Ben Ford for the technical help. This episode was recorded on Piscataway land. Please engage with this episode in some manner. Download, follow, save, like, share, or comment about something that resonated. This action ensures we are engaging the questioning community. Until next time, keep questioning.